This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Copper Sun by Sharon M. Draper, narrated by Myra Lucretia Taylor. This book opens with a poem, Heritage, by Count A. Cullen. What is Africa to me? Copper Sun or Scarlet Sea? Jungle star or jungle track? Strong bronzed men or regal black women from whose loins I sprang when the birds of Eden sang? 1 3 centuries removed from the scenes his fathers loved. Spicy grove, cinnamon tree. What is Africa to me?
Copper Sun. In spite of the heat, Amari trembled. The buyers of slaves had arrived. She and the other women were stripped naked. Amari bit her lip, determined not to cry. But she couldn't stop herself from screaming out as her arms were wrenched behind her back and tied. A searing pain shot up through her shoulders. A white man clamped shackles on her ankles, rubbing his hands up her legs as he did. Amari tensed and tried to jerk away, but the chains were too tight. She could not hold back the tears. It was the summer of her 15th year, and this day she wanted to die. Amari shuffled in the dirt as she was led into the yard and up onto a raised wooden table, which she realized gave the people in the yard a perfect view of the women who were to be sold. She looked at the faces in the sea of pink-skinned people who stood around pointing at the captives and jabbering in their language as each of the slaves was described. She looked for pity or even understanding, but found nothing except cool stares. They looked at her as if she were a cow for sale. She saw a few white women fanning themselves and whispering in the ears of well-dressed men, their husbands, she supposed. Most of the people in the crowd were men. However, she did see a poorly dressed white girl about her own age, standing near a wagon. The girl had a sullen look on her face, and she seemed to be the only person not interested in what was going on at the slave sale. Amari looked up at a seabird flying above and remembered her little brother. "I wish he could have flown that night," Amari thought sadly. "I wish I could have flown away as well." Part 1. Amari. Chapter 1. Amari and Besa. "What are you doing up there, Kwasi?" Amari asked her 8-year-old brother with a laugh. He had his legs wrapped around the trunk of the top of a coconut tree.
"For once, I want to look a giraffe in the eye," he shouted. "I wish to ask her what she has seen in her travels."
"What kind of warrior speaks to giraffes?" Amari teased. She loved listening to her brother's tales. Everything was an adventure to him.
"A wise one," he replied mysteriously. "One who can see who is coming down the path to our village."
"Well, you look like a little monkey. Since you're up there, grab a coconut for mother, but come down before you hurt yourself." Kwasi scrambled down and tossed the coconut at his sister.
"You should thank me, Amari, for my treetop adventure."
He grinned mischievously.
"Why?" she asked. "I saw Besa walking through the forest, heading this way. I have seen how you tremble like a dove when he is near."
"You are the one who will be trembling if you do not get that coconut to mother right away. And take her a few papayas and a pineapple as well.
It will please her, and we shall have a delicious treat tonight.
Amari could still smell the sweetness of the pineapple her mother had cut from its rough skin and sliced for the breakfast meal that morning. Kwasi snatched back the coconut and ran off then, laughing and making kissing noises as he chanted, "Besa, my love! Besa, my love! Besa, my love!" Amari pretended to chase him, but as soon as he was out of sight, she reached down into the small stream that flowed near Kwasi's tree and splashed water on her face. Her village, Ziavi, lay just beyond the red dirt path down which Kwasi had just disappeared. She headed there, walking leisurely, with just the slightest awareness of a certain new roundness to her hips and smoothness to her gait as she waited for Besa to catch up with her. Amari loved the rusty brown dirt of Ziavi. The path, hard-packed from thousands of bare feet that had trod on it for decades, was flanked on both sides by fat, fruit-laden mango trees, the sweet smell of which always seemed to welcome her home. Ahead, she could see the thatched roofs of the homes of her people, smoky cooking fires, and a chicken or two scratching in the dirt. She chuckled as she watched Tirza, a young woman about her own age, chasing one of her family's goats once again. That goat hated to be milked and always found a way to run off right at milking time. Tirza's mother had threatened several times to make stew of the hard-headed animal. Tirza waved at Amari, then dove after the goat, who had galloped into the undergrowth. Several of the old women, sitting in front of their huts soaking up sunshine, cackled with amusement. To the left, and apart from the other shelters in the village, stood the home of the chief elder. It was larger than most, made of sturdy wood and bamboo, with thick thatch made from palm leaves making up the roof. The chief elder's two wives chattered cheerfully together as they pounded cassava fufu for his evening meal. Amari called out to them as she passed and bowed with respect. She knew that she and her mother would soon be preparing the fufu for their own meal. She looked forward to the task. They would take turns pounding the vegetable into a wooden bowl with a stick almost as tall as Amari. Most of the time they got into such a good rhythm that her mother started tapping her feet and doing little dance steps as they worked. That always made Amari laugh. Although Amari knew Besa was approaching, she pretended not to see him until he touched her shoulder. She turned quickly and, acting surprised, called out his name. Besa! Just seeing his face made her grin. He was much taller than she was, and she had to stand on tiptoe to look into his face. He had an odd little birthmark on his cheek, right at the place where his face dimpled into a smile. She thought it looked a little like a pineapple, but it disappeared as he smiled widely at the sight of her. He took her small brown hands into his large ones, and she felt as delicate as one of the little birds that Kwasi liked to catch and release.
"My lovely Amari," he greeted her. "How goes your day?"
His deep voice made her tremble.
"Better, now that you are here," she replied.
Amari and Besa had been formally betrothed to each other last year. They would be allowed to marry in another year. For now, they simply enjoyed the mystery and pleasure of stolen moments such as this.
"I cannot stay and talk with you right now," Besa told her. "I have seen strangers in the forest, and I must tell the Council of Elders right away."
Amari looked intently at his face and realized he was worried. "What tribe are they from?" she asked with concern.
"I do not think the Creator made a tribe such as these creatures. They have skin the color of goat's milk."
Besa frowned and ran to find the chief. As she watched Besa run off, an uncomfortable feeling filled Amari. The sunny pleasantness of the afternoon had suddenly turned dark. She hurried home to tell her family what she had learned. Her mother and Esi, a recently married friend, sat on the ground, spinning cotton threads for yarn. Their fingers flew as they chatted together, the pale fibers stretching and uncurling into threads for what would become kente cloth. Amari loved her tribe's design of animal figures and bold shapes. Tomorrow the women would dye the yarn, and when it was ready, her father, a master weaver, would create the strips of treasured fabric on his loom. Amari never tired of watching the magical rhythm of movement and color. Amari's mother looked up at her daughter warmly.
"You should be helping us make this yarn, my daughter."
Her mother chided gently. "I'm sorry, mother. It's just that I'd so much rather weave like father. Spinning makes my fingertips hurt." Amari had often imagined new patterns for the cloth and longed to join the men at the long looms, but girls were forbidden to do so. Her mother looked aghast.
"Be content with woman's work, child. It is enough."
"I will help you with the dyes tomorrow," Amari promised, half-heartedly. She avoided her mother's look of mild disapproval.
"Besides, I was helping Kwasi gather fruit," Amari said, changing the subject.
Kwasi, sitting in the dirt trying to catch a grasshopper, looked up and said with a smirk,
"I think she was more interested in making love dove faces with Besa than making yarn with you."
When Amari reached out to grab him, he darted out of her reach, giggling.
"Your sister, even though she avoids the work, is a skilled spinner and will be a skilled wife. She needs practice and learning both, my son," their mother said with a smile. "Now disappear into the dust for a moment."
Kwasi ran off then, laughing as he chased the grasshopper, his bare feet barely skimming the dusty ground. Amari knew her mother could tell by just the tilt of her smile or a fraction of a frown how she was feeling.
"And how goes it with young Besa?" her mother asked quietly.
"Besa said that a band of unusual-looking strangers are coming this way, mother,"
Amari informed her.
"He seemed uneasy and went to tell the village elders." "We must welcome our guests, then, Amari. We would never judge people simply by how they looked. That would be uncivilized," her mother told her. "Let us prepare for a celebration."
Esi picked up her basket of cotton and, with a quick wave, headed home to make her own preparations. Amari knew her mother was right and began to help her make plans for the arrival of the guests. They pounded fufu, made garden egg stew from eggplant and dried fish, and gathered more bananas, mangoes, and papayas.
"Will we have a dance in celebration for the guests, mother?" she asked hopefully. "And father's storytelling?"
"Your father and the rest of the elders will decide, but I'm sure the visit of such strangers will be cause for much festivity."
Amari smiled with anticipation, for her mother was known as one of the most talented dancers in the Ewe tribe. Her mother continued,
"Your father loves to have stories to tell and new stories to gather. This night will provide both."
Amari and her mother scurried around their small dwelling, rolling up the sleeping mats and sweeping the dirt floor with a broom made of branches. Throughout the village, the pungent smells of goat stew and peanut soup, along with waves of papaya and honeysuckle that wafted through the air, made Amari feel hungry as well as excited. The air was fragrant with hope and possibility. Chapter 2. Strangers and Death. The strangers whom Besa had spoken of arrived about an hour later. Everyone in the village came out of their houses to see the astonishing sight. Pale, unhealthy-looking men who carried large bundles and unusual-looking sticks as they marched into the center of the village. In spite of the welcoming greetings and looks of excitement on the faces of the villagers, the strangers did not smile. They smelled of danger, Amari thought, as one of them looked at her. He had eyes the color of the sky. She shuddered. However, the unusual-looking men were accompanied by warriors from the Ashanti tribe, men of her own land, men her people had known and traded with. So even if the village elders were concerned, it would be unacceptable not to show hospitality. Surely the Ashanti would explain, but good manners came first. Any occasion for visitors was a cause for excitement. So after the initial amazement and curiosity of the strange men, the village bubbled with anticipation as preparations were made for a formal welcoming ceremony. Amari stayed in the shadows, watching it all, uneasy, but not sure why. Their chief, or Awoa Mafia, who could be spoken to only through a member of the Council of Elders, invited the guests to sit, and they were formally welcomed with wine and prayers. The chief and the Council of Elders, made up of both men and women, were always chosen for their wisdom and made all the important decisions. Amari was proud that her father, Komla, was one of the elders. He was also the village storyteller, and she loved to watch the expressions on his face as he acted out the stories she had heard since childhood.
"We welcome you," the chief began. "Let your yes be yes, and your no be no. May you be protected from evil, and may you live to a ripe old age. If you come in peace, we receive you in peace. Heroism is the dignity of our ancestors, and in their name, we welcome you."
He passed the wine, made from palm tree leaves, to Amari's father, then to the other elders, and finally to the strangers. The men with skin like the milk of goats and their Ashanti companions drank the palm wine from hand-carved gourds that had been decorated with ceremonial tribal designs. The newcomers then offered gifts to the chief. Small ropes of sparkling beads, unlike anything Amari had ever seen. Casks of wine, and lengths of fine cloth, so shiny and smooth that Amari marveled. She knew no human could have woven it. No real explanations for their presence had been given yet, but with the exchange of gifts, the feeling of unease began to lessen, and everyone knew that the dancing and drumming would soon begin. Ceremony was important. Business matters always followed proper celebration. It was not yet the time for questions. First came the stories, Amari reminded herself, starting to feel excited. As chief storyteller, Amari's father was highly respected. Komla knew every story, every proverb, every bit of tribal history ever told or sung or drummed by her people. He spoke at each birth, funeral, and wedding, as well as at unexpected special occasions like this. The villagers crowded around him in anticipation, although even the youngest child knew by heart every story he would tell. The strangers sat politely and waited.
"Let me tell you of the wickedness of Chief Agokoli," her father began. "He was a wicked, wicked man." "Wicked!" the people responded with enthusiasm. "He would give the Ewe people impossible jobs, like weaving baskets out of sand."
"Impossible!" the villagers responded almost in unison.
"The Ewe people finally found a means to escape from the wicked ruler," Komla recounted. "The people crept out through a hole in the wall and fooled the soldiers of Chief Agokoli." "And how did they do that?"
he asked the crowd, who of course knew the question was coming as well as the answer.
They walked backward in the dirt.
The people responded enthusiastically.
And so they did, Komla said, ending his tale with a tapping on his drum. They walked backward on the dirt path, so their footprints looked like the prints of someone arriving into the village, not departing.
He looked over at Amari as he finished the tale with a wink he saved for her alone. Everyone in the small community, including Amari, laughed and clapped their hands at the familiar story. Amari loved her father's story, and the sound of his deep, gravelly voice had always made her feel safe. Whether he was whispering silly noises in her ear, speaking formally in a meeting of the elders, or chatting with affection with her mother. To the family's great amusement, Komla would sometimes sing to them in their small hut after the evening meal. "You sound like a monkey in pain," Amari's mother would tell her husband fondly. But when he was telling stories, his voice was magical. Amari could listen to him all night. The feeling of tension faded. The drumming would come next. And, after the storytelling, this was Amari's favorite part of her village's celebrations. Amari looked around for Besa. He was the assistant to the village master arts man, the one responsible for the creation of all the dances and drum rhythms. She knew Besa would be anxious to show off his skill on the drum he had carved and painted himself. Amari was proud of how devoted Besa was to learning the rhythms. He'd told her once, "You know, Amari, the drums are not just noise. They are language. They are the pattern of the rhythm of our lives." He had no need to look at his hands to produce the drum sounds that lived within him. She loved to watch Besa stare into space, smiling as he drummed, lost in the rhythms he created. As soon as the master drummer started playing, everyone in her village felt the call. The younger boys, whose fingers itched to show their skills, grabbed their own small drums and joined the beat. Villagers began to get up and move to the rhythms. Besa played with the confidence and skill he always did. Amari's eyes were on only him. Her heart beat faster as Besa's fingers caressed the sounds out of his skin-covered drum. Drum beats echoed in the approaching darkness. The fire in the center of the assembly area glowed on the faces of the dancers, mostly younger children and women at first, but soon nearly everyone in the village joined in, even the old ones whose toothless grins spoke their happiness. All spoke to the spirits with their joyous movements. Their bodies swayed, their hands clapped, their feet stomped in glorious frenzy, all to the rhythm of the drums. The words are sounds are words from deep within, from a place that was lost, now found. Sound is self, is you, is we. Sound is past, is now, is so. From remembered past to forgotten tomorrow. Drum talk throbs, breathes life, speaks song, sings words. Warriors pulse, maidens sway, elders, children rejoice. Thrum to the heartbeat, thrum to the heartbeat. Kwasi, as round and brown as a kola nut, danced with the rest of the children, gleefully spinning in the dust. Amari watched him and remembered how he once had captured a small bird and copied its movements, flapping his arms like wings, telling her with much laughter that he intended to learn how to fly. And as Kwasi stomped and glided through the dust that evening, it seemed to Amari that he really was flying. He ran over to Amari then, breathing hard with excitement. "Come," he said, grasping her arm and trying to pull her into the dancing. "Why do you hide in the shadows? Come dance for the strangers. She pushed Kwasi away gently, reminding him she was no longer a child. She was to be married soon, and she preferred peeking at Besa, who stood behind his waist-high drum on the other side of the fire, watching her as well. The drumbeats rippled in the darkness. The dancers swayed and stomped on the hard-packed earth, and Amari's people clapped and laughed as the firelight glimmered in the night. The first explosion came from the end of one of the unusual weapon sticks the strangers carried. Louder than any beat of even the largest drum, it was followed by a cry of horror. The chief had fallen off his seat, a huge red bleeding hole in the center of his chest. More explosions followed in rapid succession. Then everyone was screaming. Confusion and dust swirled throughout the village. Amari watched, aghast, as a mother with her baby wrapped on her back tried to flee, but both mother and child were clubbed down into the dirt by one of the Ashanti warriors. An Ashanti? How could this be? Villagers ran blindly into the fire, trying to escape and screaming for mercy, only to be felled by the terrible fire weapons of the strangely pale men. Amari knew she should run. She knew she should try to escape into the forest, but her feet would not move. She could only stare in horror. She gasped as she watched an Ashanti grab her mother and try to put thick iron cuffs on her mother's wrists. She turned her head and followed, in slow motion it seemed, her father's bellows of rage as he leaped toward her mother to rescue her. But before he even reached her, one of the milk-faced men thrust a knife into his stomach, and Komla fell silently to the earth. Amari's mother screamed in anguish and bit her captor's hand. Enraged, he hurled her to the ground. Amari watched, unable to breathe or move, as her mother's head smashed upon a rock. Amari wanted to scream, "Mother, get up! Oh, please, get up!" But she was unable to say a word. Her mother did not move. Amari needed her parents to come get her, to tell her not to be afraid, to run with her into the underbrush for safety. But they just lay there, their blood beginning to stain the dust. Amari doubled over in agony. Her parents were dead. She looked frantically for Besa and Kwasi, but all was smoke and screams and death. Finally, she saw Kwasi running toward her, screaming, "Run, Amari, run!" Her feet loosened then as he reached her. She grabbed his hand, and they ran wildly out of the village into what they hoped was the safety of the darkness. Sharp branches cut Amari's face as she plunged through a thick tangle of trees. The smell of sharp, acrid smoke, not of gentle hearth fires, but of the flames of destruction, followed them. Birds and monkeys above them cried out in alarm, but their noise could not cover the screams of the slaughter of her people. Suddenly, Amari heard fast-moving, thudding footsteps behind them and the whir of a spear. Kwasi held her hand tighter, and they ran even faster, Amari trying in vain to be as invisible and swift as the wind. "Fly, my baby brother," she thought desperately. "Fly away." One moment they were leaping over a fallen log, and the next moment she heard Kwasi moan softly. Then his hand slipped slowly from hers. He slumped to the ground, a look of soft surprise on his small face. A spear had sliced through his whole little body. Amari sank down beside him and held him to her. He died in her arms. She lay there in the darkness, cuddling his small, lifeless body, unable to weep, unable to run any longer. She hardly cared when she was grabbed by one of the strangers. Her arms were wrenched behind her, and iron shackles, with heavy rusty chains between them, were snapped onto her wrists, holding them there. Amari was marched back to where the burning village had once stood so happily, grabbed by her hair, and shoved into a pile of other survivors from the village. No one spoke. No one wept. They were defeated. Chapter 3. Sorrow and Shackles. When the sun rose the next morning, Amari looked with horror at what was once her tribe's village. All of the homes had been burned, their roofs of thatch and walls of reeds consumed by the fire. The charred and bloodied bodies of relatives remained where they had fallen, with no one to perform proper rites for burials. No one to say the prayers for the dead. Amari knew that the pale strangers probably did not know their customs, could not understand the seriousness of the proper burial procedures. But the Ashanti were people of her own land, supposedly brothers in spirit with Amari's people. How could they do this and face their own future? She wondered in horrible confusion. It was just one of the many questions for which she had no answer. Where did these strangers come from? Why do they want to hurt us? How can I continue to live without my family? It took all of her strength not to look at the bodies of her parents. Amari's heart hurt in a way she could never have imagined. 24 of the villagers had survived the slaughter. She glanced around the group and realized that most of them were around her age, young, and fairly healthy. None of the elders had been spared, none of the children. Esi and her new husband, Makafui, huddled together, even though they had been shackled apart. Amari knew that Esi was carrying her first child, for she had announced it with joy just 2 days before. Amari also had seen that the parents of both Makafui and Esi were included among the dead. Kwadzo, a young man known in the village as a fierce hunter, pulled angrily at his shackles, his wrists already bleeding as he fought their restraint. A huge gash on his head had stopped bleeding, but was open and untreated. He needed the medicine woman to wrap it in healing leaves, but no one seemed concerned about his injury. All of the young male captives had sustained some type of injury. Finally, at the far end of the huddled circle of captives, Amari spotted Besa. He looked at her with glazed, saddened eyes. In the distance, where such a short time ago he had played with such power and joy, she spotted his beloved drum, crushed and in splinters in the dirt. Amari wished she could smile at Besa to give him hope, but she had no hope to offer. He looked away. Suddenly, one of the pale-faced men with the death sticks came over to them, shouting in a language she did not understand. He made it clear, however, that they were to get up from the ground immediately. Most of their captors, both black and white, carried both whips and fire sticks. Amari looked around in fear and tried to ask what was happening, but all she received in response was a vicious slice of a whip across her arms and neck. She cried out as she arched her back in pain, but she hurried to her feet and asked no more questions. She glanced at Besa. His face was distorted with anger. One of the pale men then brought out objects that she would not have used even on animals. They were similar to the iron bands on her wrists, except these fit around their necks. A length of iron chain connected each neckband, so each was linked to the next in a single file of chains and captivity. As the iron band was placed around her neck, Amari felt as if she would choke. It was cold and heavy, and cut into her shoulders. The chain was then pulled sharply as the next person in line was shackled behind her. Amari could not turn and see who it was. She could only see the person in front of her. It was Tirza, the young woman who just hours before had been chasing that runaway goat. Tirza could not stop shaking with fright. The pale-faced men fastened similar irons on their ankles, with a short length of chain between them, and a longer chain linking each person in the coffle together, thus making it impossible for them to run away or even walk very fast. Fastened together in groups of six, the wrists, ankles, and necks of each captive were painfully connected to the person on either side. Once the villagers were all linked, a white face pulled the first person with a rope, and those linked to him lurched forward as well. Amari stumbled, but the neck iron stopped her fall. She choked and tried to grab her throat, but her arms were shackled as well. Gasping, she fell into step with the others who, with heads bowed, shuffled toward they knew not what. Besa, Amari noticed, was in the front of his coffle of captives. He would not look at her, glancing away whenever she tried to catch his eye. She realized he must be feeling terrible shame. Shame that he could not rescue himself or Amari, or change any of what was happening to them. If one in their group stumbled, all of them stumbled, or sometimes even fell, choking as the chains pulled them down together. Beaten with whips if they fell, beaten if they failed to keep the pace, they headed slowly away from everything they had once known. The bright red pain across Amari's back and on her wrists and ankles made her whole body tremble. She felt as if she might pass out. The heat of the sun showed no mercy, and she couldn't even wipe away the sweat that burned her eyes as it ran down her face. Her tongue felt thick. She was so thirsty, and she couldn't remember the last time she had eaten. As she walked, she tried but couldn't comprehend the incredible cruelty of the men who had done this. Nothing made any sense. Her stomach knotted up every time she thought of her last glimpse of her mother and father, dead, unburied, and covered with flies. And little Kwasi, he was just a small boy who had never even heard a grasshopper. How could he be dead? Amari felt dizzy, but she dared not stop or stumble. The first path they traveled was the long road that led from their village to the big river several miles away. It seemed as if even the trees bowed their heads as they passed. The birds, normally full of chatter, were silent as the group marched past them for the last time. Day after day, the captives walked, saying very little to one another or to their captors. One afternoon, Amari heard Kwadzo try to speak to one of the Ashanti who guarded them.
"Why do you do this, my brother?"
he whispered when out of earshot of the white soldiers.
"Our tribes have been at war before,"
the Ashanti responded, a defensiveness in his guarded tone.
"This time, however, I shall be greatly rewarded."
He strode ahead then and said no more. Amari wondered what he meant. The wound on Kwadzo's head grew swollen and purple, and Amari could tell he was in pain. But he continued on, as they all did, one foot after the other, mile after mile. His face was one of anger and hatred. Besa's face, when she got a chance to glimpse it, had become a mask. The captives were never unshackled. Each set of six ate together, slept together, and had to urinate and defecate together. They were given just a little food each morning and very little water. Each group was forced into a rhythm, keeping a pace that was difficult for the slowest and weakest of them as they marched. In Amari's group, It was Tirsa, who seemed to have given up. She walked slowly and stumbled often. Her back was soon a patchwork of welts from being whipped when she could not keep up with the rest. One night she whispered,
"I cannot live like this, Amari. My parents, my sisters, all whom I love are dead. I would rather die than be enslaved like this."
"Tirsa, stop talking like that," Amari whispered back. "We must live."
"Why?"
she asked dully.
"Because as long as we have life, we have hope,"
Amari said fervently.
"Hope of what? Escape, perhaps." "You are a dreamer, Amari,"
Tirsa told her quietly.
"I have no dreams left."
And the next morning, Tirsa was dead. She had simply ceased breathing during the night. The leader of their captors looked at her lifeless body and cursed. He unshackled her, tossed her body to the side of the road, and spat upon it. The rest of them were told to get up and move on. Amari was surprised and saddened to realize that the travel in their chained coffle, now 5 instead of 6, was lighter and easier without Tirsa. Her heart, however, seemed to beat more slowly and heavily. None of them wept for Tirsa, or even looked her way as they passed. Chapter 4 Death March to Cape Coast. Amari lost count of the days they walked. Her neck, bruised and scarred from the iron brace around it, could barely hold her head up any longer. Her wrists and ankles were raw, where the skin had been worn away, and insects swarmed around the oozing wounds. Her bare feet left bloody footprints upon the path, sliced by every stone and sharp stick she stumbled over. At first, these difficulties bothered her, but gradually, she simply felt numb. Quadzo died one morning. Probably from his untreated wound, Amari thought, or maybe from his untreated sorrow, but she could not mourn his loss. She actually envied him. 7 others died during their long journey. Esi, the young wife of Makafui, first lost her baby, then her own life. Amari was sure she bled to death. Unable to control his grief, Makafui grabbed one of the leaders of the march and tried to strangle him with his wrist chains. How he managed to get his hands in front of him, Amari did not know. But before Makafui had a chance to succeed in killing the man, one of the others calmly picked up his fire stick and shot him. He was left on the side of the road for the hyenas, as the others had been. Amari had no idea where they were being taken or why. They just marched, prisoners in a land so full of beauty and harmony that Amari could not bear to watch the golden sun rising in the east or the freely running giraffes and elephants in the distance. Occasionally, other coffles of slaves would join their group. They looked with dead eyes at Amari and her sad little procession. No one spoke. Eventually, all of the prisoners were herded together, moving slowly down a path that was becoming increasingly wider and more well-traveled. The dirt was packed hard by the feet of those who had passed that way before. Amari wondered if they, too, had been coffled and shackled. Finally, one day, they arrived in a city, so much larger than what Amari had ever known, that she stared in wonder at the huge buildings made of stone, the variety of noises, screeching monkeys in cages, and vendors loudly proclaiming their goods from the side of the road made her head throb. She marveled at the people who lived there, people with dark and pale and even honey-colored skins. Black men and women who walked freely and laughed loudly, speaking in languages she did not know. White men walking arm in arm with black men, with no chains on either of them. Amari was amazed and understood none of it. Some of the people looked at the group of enslaved captives with pity as they were marched through the center of town, but no one made any move to help them. In fact, Amari noticed that most turned away, as if the miserable group were invisible. The air smelled salty and felt wet upon her skin. The little river in Amari's village had smelled of mud and of the animals that used it as a gathering place to drink the water. But here she could smell a larger body of water, something huge and foreign and frightening. Although Amari could not understand the language of the white men, she soon began to recognize words they repeated often, such as slave and price. Once they entered the city, she kept hearing them say, "Cape Coast, Cape Coast," with great excitement. "What is this place?" she thought to herself. "Why are we here? And how will we ever find our way back home?" Then she gasped. There was no more home. She had no more family. And for the first time, she began to weep. Amari and the rest of the captives were guided to a huge white building made of bricks and stone, larger than any Amari had ever seen or even imagined. The leader of the pale warriors barked orders to someone in a colorful uniform at a gate. Huge doors opened, and they were led inside. The bright sunlight was suddenly gone, and she had to adjust her eyes to the gloom inside the structure. It smelled of blood and death. She could hear terrifying wails that seemed to be coming from the walls of the place. Amari was filled with dread. The men were then separated from the women, and Amari's neck irons and leg irons were finally removed. She rubbed her wrists and couldn't help but breathe with relief. Nothing could be worse than what they'd already gone through, she thought. She was wrong. A huge stone door with iron bars slid open, and Amari was shoved inside a room with the rest of the women who had survived their journey. She thought she was blinded at first because the darkness was so total and sudden. The smell engulfed her next, the odor of sweat and fear, of body wastes and hopelessness. As her eyes slowly adjusted, she could see women, dozens of them, lying on the floor, huddled against the walls, curled into balls. Some of them looked up when the newcomers were tossed into the cell, but most did not bother to acknowledge their presence. Amari trembled with fear and disgust, afraid she would become like they were, afraid she already was. Amari found an unoccupied place by the wall and sat down on the floor, which was wet and slimy. The room had no window, just a large hole near the ceiling for a little bit of air to circulate. No one spoke to her. Those who were talking among themselves spoke in dialects she could not understand. Only a few could she decipher. Amari surmised that women from many different tribes and countries were imprisoned here. Igbo, Ga, and Mandinka. She was amazed at the thoroughness of their captors, how they had managed to capture so many of them. Had they murdered the families and destroyed the villages of everyone here as well? The thought of so many dead seemed to crush her. She covered her head with her arms and barely stifled a scream. No one listened. Amari gradually grew accustomed to the dim light and looked around the room. She spotted a woman in a corner who was rocking a child who was not there. She sang to it and caressed it gently, but her arms were empty. The woman's sorrow was raw and palpable, like spoiled meat. Amari's stomach growled, She could not remember the last time she had eaten, so when the guards tossed some chunks of bread through the opening, she was grateful. But by the time she got up to get some of the food off the floor, the previously quiet women had already rushed past her and savagely fought over every scrap of bread. She ended up with nothing. Amari dropped to the cold, wet floor, bowed her head, and wept. A large woman came and sat down next to her and offered her a small piece of her own portion. Amari took it gratefully.
"Crying won't help, child," she told her. "This place is slimy with tears."
Amari was surprised to hear the woman speak in her own Ewe language. She wiped her eyes and said in barely a whisper,
"I feel like a broken drum, hollow, crushed, unable to make a sound."
"You must learn to make music once more."
Amari was miserable.
"I don't understand," she told her.
"In time, you will."
Amari pondered this for a moment while she nibbled at the bread to make it last longer.
"Where is this place?" Amari asked her.
"Cape Coast Castle. It is a prison for our people. We will be held here until they have captured enough of us. Then we will be sold and sent into the sea."
She breathed deeply.
"Sold? I do not understand."
"You were chosen because you are young and strong. You survived the long journey here. You will fetch a great price."
"From whom? For what?"
Amari asked in confusion.
"Who would want to sell me or buy me? I am just a girl who has seen barely 15 summers. I have no skills."
"There are white men who will buy you to work for them by day and amuse them by night."
Amari looked up, her eyes wide with disbelief.
"How do you know this?"
"I have been sold before,"
she replied quietly.
"My master, a fat white man from this city, grew tired of me and sold me to buyers who brought me here."
"Have you been here long?" Amari asked.
"Long enough to see one group sold and sent away. We were marched into the courtyard, and white men bargained for us. One by one, they were taken through a small door. I could see the white sand and the blue of the sea beyond it, but no more. All I know is they never returned."
"Do you think they were killed?"
"No. They had value. They did not die. At least not physically," she added.
"Why were you not sold?" Amari asked her.
"I caught the attention of the leader of the guards." She paused. "He sends for me to come to him at night."
At first, Amari didn't understand, but suddenly she realized what the woman meant. Amari looked at her in horror.
"You mean he?"
"Yes, child. It is terrible. But I am allowed to bathe. I get extra food rations. I do not allow myself to think while I am with him. I hate him. But I will live. My spirit is too strong to die in a place like this."
Amari looked at this woman, at her strong body and kindly face, and began to cry once more, huge, racking sobs of despair. The woman took Amari in her arms and let her cry, the only comfort she had known since that horrible night in the village. Chapter 5. The Door of No Return. Once a day, Amari and the other women were taken from the cell in small groups. Cold water from large wooden buckets was tossed upon them. Their clothes, what little that remained, were torn and barely covered their bodies. The soldiers who guarded them liked to rip the tops off the women's garments so their breasts were exposed. Amari learned to swallow her shame. The woman who had befriended her was called Afi. She made sure Amari had food each day and protected her from some of the other women who had grown fierce and violent from their captivity. She showed Amari how to walk with a limp and look with a vacant, stupid stare to make sure the soldiers would pass her by when they looked for women to come to their rooms. She also showed Amari how to exercise inside the cell, to stay strong and ready for whatever may come next. At night, she crooned soft songs similar to the ones Amari's mother had once sung to her as a child. Afi told Amari that her husband and a daughter about Amari's age had died 2 years before. Amari figured that Afi needed her as much as she needed Afi.
"Do you think the ancestors can speak to us in this place?"
Amari asked Afi one hot night. The air was thick with the stench of excrement.
"I don't know, child,"
she replied, trying to cool Amari by fanning her with her hand. "I know they see us, however, and they weep for us. I can feel it."
"We need more than weeping, Afi,"
Amari said quietly. "We need an army of warriors to come and unfasten the locks, kill our captors, return us to our homes, and bring our families and friends back to us alive and smiling."
"You know that is not to be, my child," Afi replied gently. "We are caught in a place where there is no hope, no escape from the misery of the present or the memories of the past."
They were silent then, for there was nothing more to say. One day, without warning, Amari and the rest of the women were brought into the center of the prison by the white soldiers, who chained their hands behind them and shackled their feet as well. Then strange white men, one of them so tall and thin that he seemed to sway when he walked, looked over each of the women as if inspecting goats for slaughter. The thin man came up to Amari and lifted her upper lip, pinching the flesh with his long, bony fingers. He smelled unwashed. Amari whipped her head away from him, her eyes dark with anger. Glaring at her, he slapped her face so hard she almost fell to the ground. Then he yanked her back up, grabbed her chin, and held it tightly while he pulled at her lip again.
"Open your mouth," Afi hissed at her.
Terrified, Amari did so. The tall man took his time inspecting the inside of her mouth. He ran his fingers along her teeth and gums, mumbling to himself as he did so. When he was satisfied with his inspection of her, he moved on to the next woman. Amari stood close to Afi, shivering with fear and disgust, as the rough hands of each of the white men examined and prodded her arms, thighs, calves, and breasts. The men yelled and spoke very fast in their strange language. Amari heard the word price many times. Finally, they seemed to come to a settlement. Cowrie shells were counted and passed from the trader with the willowy body to the men who had captured them. Amari saw cloth also being exchanged, and jewelry and gold. They had very little need for gold in her village, but she knew what it was. She knew it held the value of her life. One by one, the women were taken through the door that Afi had spoken of earlier. Some screamed. Some fought back and had to be pushed. The door was narrow and very low to the ground. No one could stand upright and pass through it. The only way to go through that passageway was to crawl. A soldier grabbed Amari roughly and pushed her toward that door. He forced her to the ground and then kicked her in the direction of the